Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Stand by for today's Encore interview with Frank Conniff. But first, let's talk about protecting the title to your home with Home Title Lock. Deborah's home was stolen. I don't mean thieves stole stuff. I mean, scammers literally stole her home. The FBI calls home title theft one of the fastest growing white collar crimes. This story is why you need Home Title Lock. Deborah says criminals found the title to her home online and filed fraudulent documents claiming they owned it. Wait, it gets worse. Deborah also says she was evicted from her home and $85,000 in equity was gone. Nobody believes you can get your home stolen this easily. Folks, this is why you need to get Home Title Lock, because no insurance or bank protects your home from title theft. First things first, go to HomeTitleLock.com and register your address to see if you're already a victim and you don't know it. Then sign up to help protect the legal title to your home so you don't end up like Deborah. And to get you started, I got you 60 risk-free days of protection. Go to HomeTitleLock.com. HomeTitleLock.com. That's HomeTitleLock.com. And now, let the cartoons begin.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Zeska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, February 19, 2020, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Zeska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. On today's Encore interview, we're rewinding 1 year to February 2019, when my guest was the great Frank Conniff, TV's Frank from Mystery Science Theater and The Mads. Among other things, we talked about Frank's firing from SiriusXM, as well as his career in stand-up comedy and legendary shows like MST3K. You can follow Frank's work at Frank Conniff, two N's and two F's, on Twitter. And don't forget to check out his most recent book, Codename Douchebag, on Amazon and wherever hilarious graphic novels are sold. By the way, if you like what you hear, please consider supporting my podcast on our Patreon page, BobZeskaShow.com. And now let's return to my chat with the stupendous Frank Conniff.
Hello.
Frank Conniff, how are you? It's Bob.
Good. How you doing?
I can't help but to get your take on the Michael Cohen hearing so far. It's pulse pounding, isn't it?
Yeah, it's it's interesting. But to me, the main thing that's just very striking about it is how awful all the Republicans on the committee are.
Yeah,
and it's just the way they just want to cover up for Trump, and it's just unfathomable. And everyone's been quoting what he said, which is very apt, when he said this, you're just going to suffer for your loyalty to Donald Trump. Look at what happened to me. And that just seems so true.
Mm-hmm.
And also the great line, one of the Democratic congressmen had the great line, "They're not mad at you because you're lying for Trump. They're mad at you because you stopped lying for Trump." That was a great line.
Yeah, right. That was amazing. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, why do you think specifically, the big question is, why are the Republicans so desperate to backstop for Trump? Is it a simple electoral thing, or is there something else that's coercing them into taking this hard line in defense of an obvious crook?
Yeah, I think it's just cowardice, and I think that they think that Despite all the polls that show that Trump gets more unpopular every day, they're very worried about that so-called Republican base, I think. They're just being loyal to that. And I think they're afraid of Trump coming after them and, you know, getting nasty tweets written about them. God forbid, what a horrible thing to happen to a person to have a tweet written about them. But, you know, I mean, the Republican Party, they're, you know, Trump is a symptom of the main problem, which is the Republicans, you know, and it's just really awful.
Well, it's funny to hear them taking this liar, liar, pants on fire. In fact, they made a thing that's behind the dais in the committee room that is a giant poster that says liar, liar, pants on fire, for God's sake. They couldn't look more childish, first of all.
I know. Why didn't they write nah, 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 nah.
Yeah. Big. Later, it's wet willies and purple nurples all around for everybody. I mean, what's interesting about this, Frank, is that they're calling Michael Cohen a liar. And the thing Michael Cohen lied about to Congress the first time around was that Donald Trump isn't a crook. So what they're basically saying is Michael Cohen lied when he said Donald Trump is innocent. It just seems like a crazy, like a self-defeating suicidal tactic, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does. And, you know, nothing is shocking anymore. Yeah. And I wouldn't put anything past them. And I think if you want to have any positive aspect of all this or, you know, bring some light into the whole thing, it's just the fact that we're only having these hearings because of the midterm elections in 2018. And it's really the people who have it in their power, if only they'd use that power, that all of this can change. They're not going to change, you know, it's the voters who can make a change. And the fact that we have a Democrat controlled House of Representatives is so significant, and it's not nearly, it's not enough in terms of changing everything, but it's like I said, it's very significant. And, all of the people who worked so hard in 2018 to caucus and you know, and get the vote out. Mm-hmm. And those people are the kind of the heroes of all this.
Yeah.
And
they
people
really
who voted for Democrats. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's a really great way to put it. In fact, I think a lot of people who came out to vote, maybe even for the first time last year, were coming out to vote strictly to see what we're seeing today, strictly for that accountability to finally be handed down. Because I know I'll speak for myself in this, but I mean, I keep repeating the Jesse Pinkman line from Breaking Bad, in which he starts screaming about Walter White. He can't keep getting away with this. And it just that's the thing that motivates me more than anything else is to finally see some kind of accountability for this this cabal of criminals and liars that seems like for the last 2 years so far, all they've been is essentially normalized. Now, granted, there are lots of investigations going on all at the same time, but in that process, without having any sort of firm verdict on Trump himself and his inner circle, Don Jr., Ivanka, Jared, and all the rest, seems just increasingly frustrating to me and increasingly dangerous, that because every second they're in office is another second in which they're normalized, right?
Yes, exactly. And the you know, the corporate media plays a big part in normalizing them.
Well, you know, today is a big day because we're talking about Michael Cohen and this testimony in Congress. Everyone's glued to their television. So I want to thank you for taking the time to be on the show today, Frank. You know, and among your gigantic body of work, I also want to thank you for giving us the gift of Torgo and his puffy, puffy knees.
Torgo and Manos, the hands of fate, in some ways prepared us for Trump administration.
That's exactly right. Which member of the Trump administration would Torgo be? Have you checked out their chubby knees? Can we make that comparison?
I think Trump is Torgo and Putin is the master.
Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly the way it is. Boy, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Trump has puffy knees as well. He's got.
Yeah,
I don't know what
he does.
I don't know what they were thinking when they put together the Torgo costume when they were making that movie. Is it okay? Yeah, you know what we need is a lackey that has really chubby kneecaps. Doesn't make any sense to me.
So I think part of it was they could make, you know, they could pad out the movie because it took them so long to walk across a room. You know,
exactly.
It took up a lot of screen time.
That's right. Well, I want to come back to Mystery Science Theater here in a second, but I want to talk. Everyone's talking about Sirius XM right now, Frank, because not only are we confused and frustrated, but of course we miss hearing you on the show, on John Fugelsang's show. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm gonna miss talking to you every Monday on that show. So, What exactly? I mean, 2 weeks ago we learned that your contract wasn't being renewed, and that of course in and of itself is something that happens all the time. But then we learned that you were banned from the building. Is that true?
Although I think I think it's not a lifetime ban, is what I've heard. But they didn't want me coming back on the show. Right away, to trash them. But the thing is as someone wrote to me, and a few people have said to me the same thing, is that in radio, the way I was dismissed is very common, and they wait till the show is over, and then they call you when you get home, and then they don't want you to come back in to trash them on the air. So the way they behaved was very shady and not admirable at all. And I think that's kind of the way things are done. Yeah. I'd been on the show for 4 years, and it's just kind of sucks that they don't even give me a chance to have like a final show, kind of say goodbye to everybody. It's just like, sorry, you're gone. That's it. Moving on.
Jesus.
But hey, that's showbiz.
Was this something that you saw coming? I mean, what exactly precipitated this? I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that it seems like it's just part of the contract negotiation process ending badly, and then them doing the typical radio thing, which I'm, having come from radio, I'm quite familiar with that.
So, yeah, well, no, there was no negotiation. My contract was up for renewal, but there had been no talks or anything. What happened, from my understanding, is they didn't like that I was very critical on Twitter. I was very critical of, like, when Chris Christie was in the building, mm-hmm. Which, because I was just worried about structural damage. But other than that, he was going around and he was being interviewed on all these shows, including John interviewed him. And I just was just like, it just upsets me that these people are treated with respect. And is, now that he's left office, he's a respectable pundit now, and everybody treats him with deference. And I don't like that. I don't like it on CNN when they have these people like Rick Santorum come on and they treat them like they're sages or whatever, when all they ever did when they were politicians was do horrible things that hurt people. So I I tweeted about it, and I tweeted a poster of Chris Christie that was in the lobby of the building, and I might have said some hurtful things about him. And which I've done on the show every day, by the way, for the entire 4 years.
Yeah,
we've been trashing him. So I just, I guess I don't really fit into that corporate culture where you're just supposed to go along with it. And I also, like the next day, Howard Schultz was being interviewed at Sirius. And they have this thing in the lobby called the fishbowl, which is like this glass enclosed thing where they interview people. Everybody can see it. Right. And I took a picture of that. And I'm not a coffee drinker, but I inquired, and I was told that the coffee at Sirius is quite good. So that made me wonder, why was he in the building when he already had good coffee? So I guess they didn't like that. And then they were just like, screw you. You're out of here, man. And that was it.
It seems like it blindsided them all of a sudden that you don't have any fucks, Frank, you tell it like it is. And that, to me, that's always been, apart from being hilarious, I mean, the other Frank Conniff thing is, you always speak truth to power. You always,
that's what John and I both did on the show every day, you know, so it's just very disappointing. You know, I'm very almost obsessively critical of corporate media. I think corporate media is why we are today as much as anything, as much as any politician. You know, they did the Iraq war was sold to us by the corporate media with very little criticism. And Donald Trump, you know, received unprecedented access to airwaves and they just aired his speeches in the entirety. So it's something that weighs on me a lot. Is how awful corporate media is. But one thing I forgot was that Sirius is corporate media too, you know? So, you know, I just think people in boardrooms, I mean, it's kind of silly when you think about it, the idea that, you know, one or two criticisms for me, that they would be afraid of that, you know? I mean, I have no power over Sirius or what they do. I'm not going to hurt their bottom line one way or the other, but one thing that I did was I helped, that was with John Fugelsang and I, we had an entertaining show that people really liked and that had been renewed every year that was still on the air after 4 years. So for them to just abruptly change the dynamic of the show overnight is just very, confusing and, kind of infuriating on their part.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great combination between the two of you. And I don't think I've ever talked about this publicly, but I mean, the dynamic and the chemistry between you and John and then Rhonda Hansen being mixed into the troupe there, too. It, you know, where you've got a style where you're, you know, you're juggernaut Frank and you plow forward right to the heart of the issue. And then Fugelsang, what's kind of amazing about his style is what he'll do is he'll listen to what the other person has to say, and then he'll take all of those words and ball them up into his fist and hammer them back right at the person he's interviewing.
If
it's warranted, of course, and that's kind of his genius. Mm-hmm. And so it was this dual approach that you guys were taking, and I think taking you out of that mix is going to be negative about the show. I mean, certainly I think John can carry a show all on his own, but at the same time,
absolutely,
there's a big missing element now. It feels like there's a part missing from the show is what it feels like.
But it's also, you know, I think it's sometimes with corporations, it seems like sometimes the last thing they're thinking about is their consumers and they're thinking about other things that have more importance to them. And, you know, our listeners, who really enjoyed and supported our show over 4 years, they are subscribers. They paid to listen to the show.
Yep.
And it was a show they really enjoyed. And Sirius just decided to change that overnight. And I'm sure there weren't complaints from the listeners about me making fun of Chris Christie and Howard Schultz. So that's what they listened to the show for.
Yes, of course. Jesus, yeah. Well, you know, it's just it's really sad to see you go. And I don't mean to get overly conspiratorial and keep rehashing all this, but I mean, do you think the fact that they scaled the show back from 3 hours to 2 hours was part of this process where they're like, okay, first we're going to do this, and then we're going to not renew Frank's contract, and then maybe X, Y, and Z, something financial or something like, we don't like the show. Is it maybe a ratings thing? I don't know, but it seems like it was all part of a piece where first there was the pulling back of the overall runtime of the show, and then suddenly you're gone, and then that seems like, well, what's going to be the third shoe that's going to drop here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The thing that was, really just confusing about them scaling back our show. And by the way, no one was more supportive of the show being cut to 2 hours than me. I said, yes, 2 hours. And I love that it was like earlier in the day. And just in terms of like, you know, my daily life, it just, I considered that like a better fit for that. I could be done by two and then go home and all that. But the thing is they replaced us, and this goes back to them not really caring about the listeners and the subscribers at all. They replaced us with a 3-hour Christian financial advice show, you know,
Jesus.
Which is like the opposite of, and no one in our fan base approved of that at all. And I doubt if any of them are listening to that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they moved us to 12. And so, you know, before they did this to me, this was something where they were just screwing with our listeners and not caring about them at all by moving us and replacing us with a completely, you know, opposite type of, I mean, I could see if they replaced us with another comedian doing another show,
mm-hmm.
then that would maybe be within the same kind of vibe that we had established, but they didn't do that. They replaced us with the exact opposite of what our show is.
Yep.
And so it's just all, you know, it's very concerning. And like, I don't know how much of a future the Sirius XM Insight channel, which is the channel we were on, has. And, you know, but whatever happens, I hope that Pete Dominic, who's on in the morning, and John, who's on like right after him, that there's always, I hope there's always some place for them at Sirius XM, but I don't know if it's going to be on the, if the XM Insight channel is going to survive. Some people are worried that it's going to be like the OutQ channel, which was the gay themed channel they had, and they just disbanded the whole thing a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like John Fugelsang's entire style belongs on the Insight channel. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
he's all about the Insight, right?
Yeah, and also, you know, it's, he always liked, and so did I, that it wasn't just about politics.
Mm-hmm.
It was about whatever we wanted to talk about and about pop culture. I can give no better example of that than when I guest hosted and I spent the whole 2 hours talking about Yes, and then you called in to talk about politics, and then we found out that you did the art on a Yes album, and then it just continued being a discussion about Yes for the entirety.
That was one of my favorite appearances, because of course,
yeah,
you know, getting to talk about Yes with you, I mean, that takes me back, I don't know, 15 years when I was watching Mystery Science Theater, and suddenly the guys are telling jokes about in and around the lake, mountains come out of the sky, and they stand there,
yeah,
and I'm going, oh my God, they know. And so that was a great, I love that appearance. In fact, I wish I had a tape of that particular call, because I'd love to have a record of that. But, you know,
that was really fun.
You know, I love your movie review podcast with Trace, Movie Sign with the Mads.
Oh,
and of course,
you.
I subscribed on iTunes and everything.
And Carolina Hidalgo.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. It's the best movie review podcast out there, because, of course, it's you and it's Trace. And, you know, just it's unbelievably, I mean, talk about insightful. It's right there. I mean, obviously,
no, thank you.
An entire panel of people who know everything there is to know about film, reviewing modern movies and so on, and giving your take on what's going on in film and so on. Are you planning anything by way of a political podcast now that you've parted ways with Sirius?
I'm kind of on the lookout, and there's one podcasting network in particular that I think I'm going to meet with, and I would love to go back to doing some kind of a current events based thing. So we'll see if that happens. I mean, it's definitely something I'm kind of looking into, and so that could happen, hopefully in the near future.
Well, it's to me, it seems like, as far as politics go and getting venting and getting things off your chest and that sort of format is going to be a lot. I think you're going to enjoy that a lot more than sort of being subjected to the Sirius XM whimsy of we don't want you criticizing. We don't want you being frank. Which just seems like that was the Sirius XM line, basically.
Well, that's one of the, you know, the media landscape that we live in, I think right now would be completely disastrous, except for the fact that there's this whole world of independent media, like what you do and a lot of people do, who just put their stuff out there and through podcasts, and who are not subjected to corporate interference. They just do what they want to do. And there's a whole world of that out there. And that's such a great thing. That's such a positive aspect. And it's really, you know, this might sound like hyperbole, but I kind of feel like the independent internet journalism that's out there is really saving our democracy, because otherwise, you know, at the exact moment when they deregulated everything and then suddenly like two corporations could own everything, at that exact moment, that's when the internet came along and provided all these independent voices. And it's really just been so important. And, and you know, one interesting thing about the effect of podcasts is that, you know, when I go on the road and stuff, I hear people come up and say to me, "Oh, I really like your podcast." And I'll think they're talking about the movie one I do, but they're talking about the serious show. People refer to radio shows as podcasts now.
Yeah, funny.
Which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, you know, seeing this all happen firsthand and close up, it's interesting to observe that online publications, especially independent ones, are actually going through a bit of a recession right now, where I think Facebook is really destroying a lot of independent voices through their usual fuckery and you know, booting a lot of people and throttling the reach of certain pages and so on. But at the same time, you know, podcasting seems to be flourishing and not being necessarily affected by what's happening with Facebook and some of the other shitty things, the advertising and so on, that's damaging publications. But, you know, podcasts seem to be doing pretty well. And I'm knocking on wood, because I hope it continues that way, too.
Yeah, we'll have to hope that, you know, and of course, with net neutrality and all that stuff, I mean, they would love to just destroy all of it and make it, you know, all under the thumb of corporations. But hopefully that won't happen.
Well, it seems like this kind of thing is something that you've been prepping for your entire life, Frank. I mean, you know, your dad was a reporter for Hearst and won the Pulitzer for interviewing Nikita Khrushchev. I mean, my God, talk about a perfect storm leading up to now. I mean, you've got Russia there. What was it like around the dinner table as a kid, you know, with your dad so deeply ensconced in world events and so on? Was there a lot of political discussion in your household?
Yeah, there were, you know, my father, his work took him away a lot, but when he was at the dinner table, and even when he wasn't there, there was a lot of talk about what was going on in the world. You know, I grew up in a very, you know, a very media saturated household. In other words, like every newspaper, every magazine, was in our house all the time. And, and we were very, all of us, my brothers, my sister, my mother and me, we were all very kind of aware of that world. We knew who wrote for what newspapers, you know, we knew the names of all the writers on all the magazines. And so we would have discussions about all that stuff. It was a very stimulating kind of way to grow up, you know.
So I mean, in fact, I mean, you were just talking about the corporate media and so on before. I mean, I can imagine where you know, your dad being ensconced in all of that in the 50s and 60s, especially, you know, you have that kind of perspective where you know kind of what it used to be like, and how that kind of attitude, the kind of professionalism that I think your dad brought to the table, brought to his, you know, the world of publishing, it doesn't really exist like that anymore, does it?
Well, I think the thing is, you know, there was a lot of corporate controlling of information back then, same as there is now. But I think the difference is there wasn't, every newspaper was owned by a different company, you know? And I think, you know, that I think led to a diversity of things being printed. And even if you didn't like what was in the mainstream media, you know, you had the Village Voice and you had like kind of alternative voices, that you could read. And also, you know, newspapers weren't allowed to own TV stations and vice versa. And that was a much better way of doing things. And, you know, some of this we all have to, we really have to blame on the Clinton administration, because that's when a lot of the deregulation, it started with Reagan, and then a lot of it happened in the Clinton administration too.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, that's where things went to hell right there. You can draw direct parallels for what, you know, the deregulation of Reagan, and then the deregulation by Clinton. And now we're seeing all kinds of additional deregulation by Trump that, you know, it's not going to take 10 years, but certainly in the not too distant future, pardon the pun, we're going to be talking about how Trump destroyed so much of what was remaining of of regulation.
Whatever happens with Trump, however long he's in office, even if he leaves office tomorrow, it's going to take a long time to fix a lot of the mess that he's making and continues to make. It's very scary.
No doubt. I mean, were you, you were talking about how media was a big part of your childhood. I mean, were you a cinephile as a kid, or was that something that kind of happened later?
Oh, no, as a kid as well, I was very into movies and, and very into show business and, becoming a comedian was something I started thinking about very early in my life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my dad was friends with comedians. He was friends with Jackie Gleason. He was friends with Phil Silvers.
Wow.
He was friends with Joe E. Lewis. And so I have a lot of comedian friends who they're like, when I was a kid, I never would have thought of being a comedian. Then I just happened to drift into it. But I kind of grew up around the whole milieu. Ed Sullivan was, people don't remember this, Ed Sullivan was a newspaper columnist who had a newspaper column, even when he had his TV show. So my dad knew him. So that whole world of show business was something that I was very aware of, and the world of movies and television. And I was always just interested in it right from the start.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because a couple of weeks ago I interviewed Edie Adams' son, Josh Mills, for Ernie Kovacs. It was Ernie Kovacs' 100th birthday, I think, last month. And it's well known that Joel Hodgson is a Kovacs-style comic who was, in fact, I think he won the first ever Ernie Kovacs Award.
Yeah, Joel was friends with Edie Adams. The one time I met her was Joel introduced me to her at a party in L.A. one time.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, do you have a similar connection to Ernie's comedy as Joel does?
Well, I have that connection of appreciating it, and also, being influenced by all the stuff that Ernie Kovacs influenced, like Letterman and all that stuff. And Steve Allen. I think Steve Allen is probably, in terms of his work as a broadcaster, is at least as influential to me as Ernie Kovacs.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely have that kind of connection to all that stuff.
In fact, if Kovacs were around, and I think he would do this certainly when he was working in television and so on, but, you know, I think Ernie Kovacs was also an influence of Steve Allen, where he was saying that Kovacs would complain that Steve Allen was stealing, like, Mr. Question Man and some of his bits. And
people like Kovacs, people now who, younger comedians now who aren't aware of him, they're still influenced by him, because they're influenced by the three generations of people who were influenced by Kovacs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get back to our conversation with Frank Conniff here in just one second. But first, I wanted to give you the latest news about liberal broadcaster Bill Press. Bill no longer does his progressive morning show, but that doesn't mean he's gone away. No way. He's out now with a great new podcast, The Bill Press Pod, dropped twice a week. Check out The Bill Press Pod for Bill's interviews with some of the country's leading progressives like Maxine Waters, Mark Poken, Jamie Raskin, all roasting Donald Trump. Plus his lively end-of-the-week roundtable with three of Washington's top political reporters commenting on the latest craziness from the White House, Congress, and the 2020 Democratic primary. For years, Bill Press has been one of the leading progressive voices in the country, so I'm glad he's still out there on the left stronger than ever. I encourage you to join me by subscribing to Bill's new podcast. Just go to wherever you get your podcast, search for The Bill Press Pod, click on subscribe, and you're in for a true progressive experience on The Bill Press Pod. Okay, now picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about crow's feet or those large under eye bags? Now imagine that they're gone. And I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery. I'm talking about gone in just a matter of minutes. We're talking, of course, about Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under eye bags in just a matter of minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. And if you don't believe it, I didn't either until I took the test and I was blown away by the results. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. Then the best part is Plexiderm goes on clear, so no one is going to know that you're using it unless you tell them, of course. Go to tryplexiderm.com. Use my code VOICES for 50% off a full-size bottle of Plexiderm, plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off, plus an extra $10 off. This offer is available by calling 1-800. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning the code VOICES. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit triplexiderm.com today and use the code VOICES at checkout. That's triplexiderm.com, code VOICES.
The Bob Seska Show.
Was there kind of an epiphany moment for you, Frank, where you discovered that you could make people laugh and learn that there was power in that? Was there? Did you kind of go through that?
I'm still waiting for that moment, but I don't know. I mean, I really, when I was in school, as I was I was a total wise ass, and it was something I could do when I was a kid, was make other people laugh. But becoming a stand-up comedian was not an easy road for me. I mean, it took me a long time to really figure it out. And learn how to do it. I know for some people it comes easily. It was a really long, hard road for me, which I think had to do with personal issues of self-doubt. And also, I had an alcohol and a drug problem. And so I think something that when I look back on it, if I had the wisdom I have now, then I think I could have very easily just gone up and become a stand-up comedian, but it really took me a lot of trial and error till I got any good at it.
Yeah. What were your substances of choice? You said you had a drug and alcohol problem, which actually, in effect, I don't want to put the cart ahead of the horse here, but that led you to Minnesota, which then led you to MST3K. What were you? What made you decide I've got to drop these addictions and seek help? I mean, what were you doing at the time?
I was into, alcohol, and I liked cocaine, and I liked to smoke a lot of pot and, take whatever was available. But what really led me to recovery was just the knowledge that anything that I wanted to do in my life, all of the dreams that I had, and I had some big dreams, but they were not attainable as long as I had substance abuse in my life, And that's what really kind of motivated me. But I was also very much helped by my family, which staged an intervention and sent me to Minnesota. But the reason my recovery took, I think, was just my knowledge that this is the only way that I can become a comedian, that I can become a writer, that I can have a career that I want to have. I can't do it while I'm taking drugs because they get in the way of everything, And so I think that motivated me.
It seems like there might have been a motivation to get involved in drugs and alcohol abuse and all the rest of it, because there's kind of this attitude that creative people have these demons, and in order to be a successful creative person, you too have to have those demons. Was there a pressure there? Did you feel like, things aren't happening as quickly as I want with stand-up comedy and so on, so maybe if I do what Richard Pryor is doing, or George Carlin, or some of these other guys?
I mean, I don't think I thought that way. I mean, I think it was just that I have an addictive personality, and once I started doing these addictive drugs, I became an addict, And it really wasn't, I didn't feel like it was, it helped my creativity or anything like that. I think it was just that I have a natural tendency to have an addictive personality. And once I got involved with these things, there was no stopping me, you know. And, you know, and I kind of believe all that stuff about, you know, it's very harmful to think that you would need drugs to be creative. I mean, I think, you know, Charlie Parker, like, ruined a whole generation of jazz musicians because they thought they had to take heroin because Charlie Parker did, you know. It's I can understand when you're young why you would think that way, but for musicians or comedians or writers or any kind of creative person, it's the whole idea that drugs helps your creativity is just a myth, and it's not true.
Yeah. And is that something you kind of discovered before you left for Minnesota? Because you went to Minnesota for rehab, right? And then is that something?
Yeah, I went to Minnesota for rehab, and that was, you know, I had tried to get off drugs before, and it didn't take. And I think it was very good for me to just get away from New York, which is where I got into all the trouble that I got into.
Yeah.
And just have a completely fresh start. You know, I could have come back home after I was in rehab, but I made a decision to stay in Minneapolis. And plus, you know, Minneapolis is such a great city, which I never thought about Minneapolis in my life, except for watching the Mary Tyler Moore Show, you know. And it's such a great place. It's such an intelligent, cosmopolitan town filled with creativity, creative people. And I just loved it there, you know. Yeah. And so it was just kind of, I was extremely lucky in the way things turned out once, but I wasn't able to have any of that luck unless I got sober.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been culture shock going from New York City in the 70s to Minnesota at that same time, right? You know, just the vast differences between those two environments.
Yeah.
Must have been mind-blowing.
I mean, it is a different vibe and a different culture, a little more laid back, and there's a whole Midwestern kind of culture and way of viewing things that was new to me. But I kind of took, I don't know if I had a big culture shock. I think I took to it very quickly, and you know, and when I moved to LA, you know, everyone knew that I was, you know, I was a Minnesota comic, and there are so many great Minneapolis comedians, and a lot of them were in LA then. And so a lot of people that I met out in LA just assumed that I was born and raised in Minneapolis because I have more of that kind of laid back vibe anyway, you know?
Yeah.
So it just was a very suitable place for me. And I go back there once or twice a year now. And I always love going back there.
And so once you're out of rehab, you're doing stand-up comedy in Minneapolis.
Yeah. Once I got out, I started doing stand-up in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And there was like, you know, there was another very lucky thing. This was like 1985, 1986. And there was just this, you know, that was the height of the 80s comedy boom when there was a comedy club on every block, you know.
Right.
In every apartment had a comedy club. You know,
what were some of the names of the comedy clubs in Minneapolis? Were they the typical Yuck Yucks and things like that?
Yes. Well, actually, the very first club I played was called the Ha Ha Club. The Ha Ha Club.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
And, and the thing about that was good was that they didn't serve alcohol there. It was kind of like a really good place for me to start out being a newly sober person. And then after a couple of months, I finally kind of decided that even though I was worried about being around alcohol, I had to go to the Comedy Gallery, which was the other comedy club in Minneapolis. And that was really the center of stand-up comedy in Minneapolis at that time. So I really felt like I had to go there. And so I did. And, you know, and I made so many great friends. And it was just a really wonderful experience.
What was your act like at that point in time? Like, what kind of material were you doing?
Like autobiographical, self-deprecating kind of what I'm still doing, you know.
Right.
Not really. Like what I'm doing now is just like a more a better version of what I used to do then. But it was just a very fun thing, and because it was this comedy club boom, it was kind of fortuitous that once I sobered up and once I was doing comedy, then I like right away I started getting work. Because there were all these like one-nighters, and there was a circuit you could do around the Midwest, like Iowa and North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin, and so I was making a very meager living, but I was making a living doing comedy, and that was amazing to me at the time.
Yeah. It seems like there's an apprehension when it comes to comedy club owners about hiring comics who are just hammered all the time. Like if you look at it, for example, Bill Hicks's career, where he started out totally straight edge, where he wasn't doing anything. And he was getting a lot of work, and he was generating a lot of buzz for himself. And then suddenly he started drinking, and the comedy club owners are like, "I don't know about this guy because he's going way off the rails."
Yeah.
So it's an interesting dynamic in terms of what the outside perception is of stand-up comedians and substance abuse versus what the reality is. And I think it's a lot different than what people assume. But so there in Minneapolis, you're doing stand-up comedy, and then of course you end up meeting up with Joel Hodgson, J. Elvis Weinstein, the Mystery Science Theater crew, and they were already underway doing the first season, right? When you met up with them, is that true?
Oh yeah, in fact, they had done two seasons because they did their first season on a local Minneapolis Twin Cities channel, KTLA. Right.
if you can find those episodes on YouTube, they're amazing. Those are early, like cable access, right?
Wasn't early. No, it wasn't cable access. It was a UHF station.
Oh, okay, great.
And then the show got picked up by the Comedy Channel, which is now known as Comedy Central. But then it was the Comedy Channel, and they did a whole season there before I joined. And then J. Elvis Weinstein, who was on the show, he left the show, and he was like the mad scientist assistant, and he was a writer there, and a brilliantly funny person. He left the show, and then there was an opening, and then I just got a phone call, and I got the job. So it was as simple as that. Just because I knew all those guys.
Interesting.
Mike Nelson, who was the head writer of the show, I met him when he was like doing his first open mic. I knew all these people. Joel was the only one that was, had already had a career in L.A. and had already been on television. At Trace Beaulieu, who I still work with a lot, I just met him at that club I just mentioned, the Haha Club. That's where I met Trace Beaulieu. So these were just all my friends who were doing the show. And then when an opening came up, they knew me. They knew that I was funny, and they also knew that I had this encyclopedic knowledge of movies and show business, which is very appropriate for the show. So it was just all very, very lucky for me.
It's really like the Beatles coming together in a way. And I know Fugelsang will love that reference, but the story of the show is kind of a miracle. It's like a perfect storm insofar as it was a completely original idea. There were movies that could be legally used. There was a world-class group of you guys, of comedians, elevating it far beyond the original concept. I mean, was there a sense from the beginning, from the first time you you stepped into that role, was there a sense that, TV would never allow such a perfect comedic show to actually survive? I mean, did it seem like it was too good to be true?
Well, yeah. I mean, nobody thought that it would, nobody knew how long it would last. And when I was there, I was like, oh, this is great. Like for maybe the next, for the next 8 months or so, I don't have to worry about money getting gigs because I have this steady thing, but I didn't, there was no sense on anyone's part that it would last a long time. But the thing is, that was also very lucky about it is back then, like basic cable was much more like kind of an off-Broadway of television back then, much more than it is now, yeah. You know. In other words, they were willing to do experimental things and try different kinds of programming. And plus, Mystery Science like filled up 2 hours of programming very cheaply. And, mm-hmm. and don't think that was an insignificant factor in why it was picked up. You know, it was just, this is cheap. It'll fill up 2 hours. We can put it on. And, you know, and that was a part of it. And so we really were given the room to just do what we wanted to do. And, you know, it wasn't considered mainstream or anything, but there was still like a viable place for it on television. And, you know, that it was just, it was just like you said, it was kind of like a perfect storm of things that, yeah. that came together.
Well, that Comedy Channel at that point in time that eventually became Comedy Central, I mean, that was an amazing yeah. time to watch that channel, because it's really all about you guys and the Alan Havey show, which was, I mean, between
yeah,
those
Havey.
Two. Yeah, Night After Night was just an amazing yeah. kind of late night show that Alan Havey hosted. And it was just, it fit together with what you guys were doing, because a lot of it seemed, well, of course, you guys were writing all of your material, but so much of it seemed like it was improvised. And that's what yeah. really, because it felt like that Wild West environment for
yeah,
television
yeah,
comedy.
Absolutely.
That, yeah.
And also, Night After Night. The co-host of Night After Night, the sidekick, was Nick Bakay, who I ended up working with in L.A. He's one of the funniest people in the world.
Oh, yeah. God, I remember what he used to do. Like, he used to talk about the bottomless cup of Tang. I think that was one of the fake prizes that they would give away on that show. God, I miss those guys. Yeah, it's been a long time since I thought yeah. about that show. But, I mean, it was right there, mm-hmm. hand-in-hand with MST3K as far as bringing Comedy Central into the mainstream. And, you know, again, it's one of those things where you look at a show like MST3K and you wonder, good Lord, how did that manage to survive? And in fact, the story of the show is one of ongoing struggles to survive. Don't you think? It's like you guys were fighting almost an uphill battle with, you know, something that I obviously now and future television historians are going to look at it as something that was so utterly genius and groundbreaking that it's kind of unheard of to think of it as being a show that was constantly embattled with the network. Isn't that, I mean, that was something you guys were dealing with a lot.
Well, I don't know. At Comedy Central, at least, like, I don't think we were really that embattled with the network. Mm-hmm. And I say this in hindsight, because it was my first TV show, like I didn't know that having complete creative freedom was like a unique thing in television, you know. And so it was really kind of an ideal situation we had at Comedy Central, where they just, part of it was because we were in Minnesota and they were in New York, you know. Mm-hmm. Where we just never got notes, we never got any kind of development meetings with them. We just made the show and sent it to them. That was all there was to it. Mm-hmm. And but I think that the show staying on the air for so long, I think that had a lot to do with the fans of the show, who might have been small but were a very vocal minority. And yeah. when Comedy Central canceled the show, it was only because of an outpouring of fan support and mm-hmm. petitions, and that the Sci-Fi Channel picked them up. And then it was on for another like 3 years after that.
Yep.
So, you know, it really is a show that could have just stayed on the air all the time. But, you know, eventually after 10 years, it got canceled. But 10 years is a long run.
It is. It actually is very respect, especially given the kind of show that it was. And that's what makes it so impressive that something like that managed to squeeze through the loopholes of television, make it on the air and survive for
yeah.
10 years. What was your, a lot of people obviously recognize you as TV's Frank, as an on-air performer, mm-hmm. but I don't think a lot of people realize that you were specifically involved in the selection and review of the movies that were chosen. What was that? What was that process like?
Well, that was we kind of haphazardly picked movies. we would watch them for 10 minutes and say, yeah, that seems like it'd be good. And what happened was we did a movie called The Side Hackers, and then we picked it, we approved of it, it was paid for, and then we watched it, and then, you know, we had watched 10 minutes of it, and then when we were finally writing it, we find out 20 minutes in, there's like this brutal rape scene in it, and it's not the kind of thing we wanted to joke about or riff about, so we cut that scene out, but then we decided, you know, we have to watch the whole movie before we pick them, so then that job was given to me because everyone else at the staff at the time everybody was multitasking. You know, Trace Beaulieu was a writer, but he was also designing the sets. And Kevin Murphy was a writer, but he was also literally editing the show. He was in the editing room a lot. Wow. And Mike Nelson was a writer, but he was also doing a lot of the music for the show. And I was a writer, and I had no other talent. So they gave me the job of watching the movie, and it fell to me.
It seemed like such a time-consuming task. Are you spending like all of your work time and your free time doing that?
You know what? I think there was one after, you know, we had like a 9-day production cycle, and one of those days would just be my day to screen movies. And, you know, it was pretty great. You know, I basically went into work and got into my cubicle and just watched movies all day. I mean, what could be bad about that? That's a good gig to have.
Right.
You know?
You know, one of the things you were mentioning about that that one film that had the rape scene in it, but I mean, one of the things that I really responded to about the show, one of the many things, was that occasionally there would be something that was obnoxious or not politically correct in one of the movies. Like, I remember in Mitchell, there was like a lot of like Hispanic derogatory phrase. I think at one point someone uses the phrase or uses the word wetback or something to describe this right. Hispanic character, and everyone goes, all in unison, hey, which is just a great way to react to something like that. I love that you guys included some of those little details from the movies in there rather than necessarily shying away from some of the
and you know, people put down political correctness as it applies to comedy, but we were kind of ahead of our time in being politically correct, and just in the sense that we were very aware, like, we never wanted to do stuff that would be offensive to women or that would be offensive to gay people. Mm-hmm. And so we were very cognizant of that kind of thing. And we had a rule, a very, hardline rule on the show was that if anybody objected to a joke and it made them uncomfortable, we would just automatically drop the joke. There wouldn't be a debate about it. Maybe, you know, there could be a debate about it, but it was ironclad that the person who said, I don't like that joke, I don't want it in the show, it would get dropped from the show. And, you know, and I think all these years later, I think it's a really good thing that we did that, because I think when you watch a lot of comedy from the 90s or the 80s, there's a lot of stuff that just has not survived the test of time. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of like homophobic stuff, misogynistic stuff. And I don't think you'll find a lot of that on Mystery Science Theater episodes. And that was a conscious thing on our part.
Yeah, no, the jokes never went there. It was the reaction to what was it, the content of the films that were being commented upon. And that was... This is great. But, you know, we all have our favorite episodes, Frank, but which specific episode of the show, and I guess this would involve the movie as well, and chiefly, best represented what you wanted to achieve with the show? Like, what's the one episode that you feel like, okay, now if they remember me for this episode, I'll be satisfied?
Oh, that's really hard to say, you know, because, you know, there's so many episodes, and a lot of them I don't even remember. I mean, it's a lot of it is a blur to me. But, you know, I would say, like, something like Mitchell would be very representative.
Yeah.
Cave Dwellers, I think, was a really strong episode. And the one
Manos, of course. Yeah.
Oh, I'm not even remembering the name of it, but the one with Trumpy in it was.
yeah.
You know, that was a really good episode that people remember. And, you know, there was a line in it that a character said, Trumpy, you can do magic things, which is now people. I've wrote it on Twitter and other people have wrote it about Donald Trump saying, Trumpy, you can do racist things, you know. So it's. Yeah, I think those, but there are probably other episodes too, but I just can't think of them. I Accused My Parents was another one that I always really liked. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the shorts, you guys did a lot of shorts too, and those are really underrated. Yeah. In fact, for the longest, I got really familiar with the shorts that you guys would do because I, for the longest time, one of the earliest things I ever did in blogging was every Saturday morning, I would go to YouTube and try to find an MST3K short to post on my blog because you know, I missed watching the show on Saturday morning. So that was one of my favorite aspects of those. If you can find those shows on YouTube or those particular clips of the shorts that were done.
Yeah, the shorts are really some of the strongest parts of the show. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I know that I always, Mr. B Natural was a favorite.
Yeah.
And there was another one, you know, the thing that was fun about the shorts is they really were very indicative of American attitudes in a certain time and place. And, of what the people in charge, you know, in charge of education in America, the values that they were trying to convey, to impressionable young minds, and it's really hilarious. There was one film I think my favorite of all the shorts we did was called A Date with Your Family, mm-hmm. which was about how to behave at a family meal. And it's just hysterical that it's just, you know, any kind of emotion is not welcome, you know, just suppress everything. Don't upset your father. You know, it's just those films did a lot of the work for us in terms of, you know, generating the comedy, because even without the riffing, those things are hilarious to look at.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you must have seen some of those. And as soon as you pop the tape in the deck and it starts rolling, your mouth must have been watering for like, oh, my God, this can't possibly exist for me.
I know. It's they're amazing to watch. And it is like some of the best moments on the show, I think, for the shorts.
So why did you end up parting ways with the show? Why did you end up leaving the show?
Well, I've been on the show for 5 years, and I was just really, you know, itching to kind of see what it would be like to work on different kinds of shows, you know, mm-hmm. To be a comedy writer in other settings. You know, you talked about my childhood earlier, and I think that, you know, ever since when I was a kid and I would watch the Dick Van Dyke Show, and, you know, he was a comedy writer on the show. And I think from the moment I heard that comedy writer was a job that you could have, it's something that I wanted to do. So, you know, so I was just anxious after doing a lot of Mystery Science Theater episodes. I was anxious to go to L.A. and see if I could work on a sitcom, work on a sketch show or a late night talk show and animated shows. I worked on all kinds of shows in all kinds of genres. You know, it's just something I really wanted to do. It was a difficult transition, but I was very happy that I did it. And another thing that was great when I moved to LA in like 1995 mm-hmm. was there was this great alternative comedy scene out there at the time. And so I was able to become a part of that like right away. And that's where I made a lot of friends that I'm still friends with to this day, like Patton Oswalt and Paul F. Tompkins and mm-hmm. David Cross and Karen Kilgariff and Laura Keitlinger. And it was kind of a very creative period to be out there.
Yeah, it was great to see that, especially emerging after the stand-up comedy of the 1980s, to have that alternative scene, where, in fact, it was quite successful there for, you know, especially the latter half of the 90s, where, in fact, you know, a lot of those comics ended up on shows like Mr. Show on HBO, and there was such a platform for that, and now it's almost full circle with the rebooted MST3K with Patton Oswalt playing your son, basically, the son of TV's friend.
I know.
Which seems like, I mean, it's...
I know.
Does that feel like a gigantic compliment to you as far as knowing how talented Patton Oswalt is and that he's playing...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's playing a character.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling was, if they're gonna cast someone else to play that part, I was glad it was Patton. You know,
Was there a part of you that wished that it had been you, that they had recast you?
I don't know. I mean, I think the one thing that was disappointing to me about it was that I wasn't kind of asked to be part of the creative team of it. Mm. And that's something I think I would have seriously considered doing, is helping to write it and helping to conceive it, and, you know, just like I used to do on the show. You know, I think Joel always wanted to have a whole new cast for the reboot, but I wouldn't have mind being a part of the creative team of it. So that was a disappointment to me.
So, but you were getting along with Joel and everything with Cinematic Titanic and that particular project that kind of led into the reboot. So there were no tensions between you and Joel, were there?
Not significant ones, I'd say. You know, I think that Cinematic Titanic was a great experience, and it's something I wouldn't have mind to have kept doing, but I think Joel always had it in his mind that he wanted to do the Mystery Science Theater reboot. Mm-hmm. And when he finally got the rights to do it, he wasn't able to do it for years because he didn't have the rights to it. Once he got the rights back, he decided to do it, and he wanted to do it with a whole new cast and everything. And so that's just something that there was intention about it, but it was just something that I was just never going to get to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. But, you know, in the meantime, in the interim there, you worked in some animation. In fact, you worked on Invader Zim, which I think was a tremendous show that strangely didn't last very long. And I never understood why it had such a short lifespan. I think it was like, what, a season and a half?
Yeah, I don't really understand that either. Yeah. I don't understand that either. And, you know, it's a show that people love. It's this. When I do appearances and I'm at the merch table signing stuff and people come up and talk to me, that's the show besides Mystery Science Theater that people will talk more than any other show I've worked on. Besides Mystery Science Theater, Invader Zim is the one that always comes up. And I think, and most of the people I know in the world of animation, and I think everybody agrees that if Nickelodeon had kept that show on the air, it probably would have been another SpongeBob in terms of how successful it would have been. But for whatever reason, they canceled it after one season, and I think it was a huge mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. This is kind of a stupid move, but again, indicative of a lot of what we see in television, where a lot of times good shit is killed prematurely, and again, another reason why...
Hey, you know what? It happens in radio too.
Yes, as we've all badly witnessed here. Tell me about real quick. I want to let you go here in a second, but tell me about Codename Douchebag.
Oh, Codename Douchebag is a novel that I put out a few months ago, and it's about a group of washed up conservative news pundits who want to win the love and get back in the game of profiting from their conservatism and getting back on TV. And so what they do is they come up with a commando plan to do a raid on an Aspen Institute that's going to be filled with liberals, and they're going to blow it up. And the liberals are, it's the annual meeting at this Aspen place where they're presenting the latest upgrade of Grey Poupon mustard. So that's the story of the book, and it's told entirely in tweets between the characters.
Are you working on any more books at this point? Is there another project you've got your eyes on?
I have one that I'm not ready to talk about, but is going to come out sometime this year. And I always have something like that that I'm working on. So I'm excited to just keep producing stuff like that.
Well, Frank, I have to tell you, this has been a gigantic honor for me. I can't thank you enough, not only for, of course, being on the show, but also for helping to create one of the greatest comedic programs in the history of television. It doesn't seem like it was actually real that kind of show like that was able to make it on the air and be successful for so long. And goddamn, thank you for all of that.
Oh, thank you, and it's great to be on your show. You know that I'm a fan, and it's great to be able to talk to you now that we don't have our regular Monday time to chat.
Oh, and thank you for all the Yes references on the show. I want to mention that again, too.
my pleasure, believe me.
All right, Frank. Well, thank you, and we'll be in touch. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Bob. Take care.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, now picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about crow's feet or those large under eye bags? Now imagine that they're gone. And I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery. I'm talking about gone in just a matter of minutes. We're talking, of course, about Plexaderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under eye bags in just a matter of minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. And if you don't believe it, I didn't either until I took the test and I was blown away by the results. Plexaderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. Then the best part is Plexaderm goes on clear, so no one is going to know that you're using it unless you tell them, of course. Go to tryplexaderm.com. Use my code VOICES for 50% off a full-size bottle of Plexaderm, plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an extra $10 off. This offer is available by calling 1-800. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning the code VOICES. Plexaderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit triplexaderm.com today and use the code VOICES at checkout. That's triplexaderm.com, code VOICES.